were just mad about Tommy Walton, who Chef Gordon Ramsay said was one of the most memorable people he's ever met on his reality TV cooking competition, MasterChef. But besides being a fierce queen in the kitchen, Chef Tommy Walton also cuts it up in the sewing room. As a teacher to the future Alexander McQueens of the world in the fashion department of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
Today we chat with Chef Tommy Walton about his stint on reality TV, his wild fashion sensibility, and how he managed to convince one of the contestants that he was a vampire.
Plus, Caviar Club, Tommy's upcoming performance art dining extravaganza.
Being personal chef to Richard Pryor.
And how to keep it together when your everyday life is the movie Mahogany. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Cooking with Drag Queens is a hit, with two more episodes to go, featuring the legendary Lady Bunny, who inspired the whole series with her 80s camp cooking video, Strawberry Shortcut, and everyone's favorite Russian mail order bride from RuPaul's Drag Race, Katya Zamolichikova. We are wrapping up season one. But because we know you're hungry for seconds, let the Season 2 Kickstarter commence. Please take a moment and check out the video on our Kickstarter page, kickstarter.com/profile/feast of fun.
Our guest today has been called by Chef Gordon Ramsay one of the most memorable people on the reality TV cooking competition, MasterChef. But besides being a fierce queen in the kitchen, Chef Tommy Walton also cuts it up in the sewing room, teaching the future Alexander McQueens in the fashion department of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago how to work the runway, sweetie. Welcome, Tommy, to Feast of Fun.
Thank you, Fausto, my darling.
I have been a longtime fan of your extravagant fashion photos on Facebook.
Mm.
For years, I've always been like, who is this queen? What school of fashion is that? Like haute couture? Fashion victim.
I think you have to probably say it is Franco-Japanese high fashion.
Yeah, it's asymmetrical, dazzling, very formal, and wild.
Yeah. Well, I really don't like being casual. I don't wear jeans. I don't have khakis. I don't have, like, gym shoes and things like that. I never went in that direction. I was always, from a very young age, interested in haute couture and high fashion. And then my husband, Roger, just happened to become a buyer for some of the top Japanese companies in Paris. So he was going to Paris back in the 80s during the supermodel era. And he was the buyer for Comme des Garçons, Yoji Yamamoto, Vivienne Westwood, Junko Shimada, Masaki Matsushima, Junya Watanabe, all of them. And I was such a tiny little thing that I was able to wear samples. So as a result, my clothing collection is pretty extreme. And I wear the things that no woman can wear and no man can wear.
No man would dare wear. What is it they say in the movie Car Wash? It's like,
I'm more of a woman than you'll ever get and more of a man than you'll ever be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of like reverse. I am. Yeah. I always say too, some people go, are you a girl? Are you a boy? Are you a man? Are you a woman? I am. I'm all of that. I'm a woman. I'm a woman with something extra, though.
Now, on MasterChef, this is, for people who haven't seen the show or may not be familiar with, the premise is kind of like RuPaul's Drag Race, only it's food personalities all battling it out. Every week, they give you kind of like a different challenge, right?
Yes, yes. Every week, there's a different surprise challenge. You have no idea what's going to happen. And then there's also mystery boxes that can be part of a challenge where you don't know what's in the box. And they give you just a few minutes, and really just a few minutes, like 3 or 4 minutes, yeah, to tell them what the dish is going to be after you just laid eyes on, you know, a goat's head.
So they really try to push you, huh?
But you don't have to make it. You just have to identify what you're going to make.
Well, you have to kind of come up with a dish. You know, okay, you have to come up with a dish when you see what your ingredients are going to be.
Now, behind the scenes, did you have access to, like, cookbooks or the internet or
no?
Because I always see those competition shows, and I'm always wondering, like, how do they get fresh pomegranates to throw in that salad, you know?
No. Whatever is in that pantry, you never know what's in that pantry. And they won't let you get used to what's in the pantry because everything changes every day.
Okay.
And it's always the coolest stuff. There's never really anything terrible. I mean, other than there was once, there was just a cup of coffee.
Just a single cup of coffee.
We had to do something with coffee.
Yeah.
That freaks you out. But you have no computer access. I was unplugged for a good 3 months. I have no cell phone, no computer. And by the time you're on the show and the pressure is building, the idea of reading a cookbook and memorizing a recipe is not going to happen. So you've got to have it built in. You've got to have sense memory. You've got to remember flavors. You've got to remember plating. You've got to have had a lot of practice at home before you would dare do MasterChef.
You've cooked as a career, though. It has been part of your
career. Oh, well, I've cooked my whole life. You know, I think I made my first, you know, when I was little, I used to watch Sesame Street and I watched The Electric Company.
Yeah.
And that was on PBS in Chicago on Channel 11. And then right after that was Julia Child.
So that's right.
Out of default, I'd still be playing with my Jacks after Sesame Street and Julia Child came on. So I wound up watching that as a child. And they're talking about crepe Suzette's and, you know, tête de veau and stuffed cabbage. So I made my first dinner for my parents when I was 8 years old. And it was Polish stuffed cabbage.
Mm.
How strange and alien is that? For me, the black boy in the south side of Chicago who never met a Polish person ever. Here I'm making galopki. Stuffed cabbage, and I didn't want to eat it. I wanted them to eat it. And that's kind of still how I am today. I will do all the cooking, and I'm not a taster in the kitchen while I'm cooking. I will cook, get my seasonings right through sense memory. I just know how things are supposed to be put together, and then I want everybody else to eat it.
So was there any time that you wish you had the proper ratios of how much baking soda to put in a cake, for example?
You mean you're talking about baking? Because baking is an exact science. Cooking and doing meats and doing vegetables and things, everybody can be spontaneous and, you know, think
freewheeling.
You can fudge it. You can rearrange the flavors and everything, and you know your vegetables. But a cake, a souffle, a tart shell, a pie crust, you absolutely have to know and remember the formulas and the science of baking, because baking is absolutely, you can't play around with
it. Well, I think as Americans, we don't grasp the science or the understanding the way Europeans do about baking, because they weigh their ingredients. And so they're very conscious about the fact that you need, you know, 5 grams of this and, an ounce. Whereas we do it by volume.
Yes.
And so we have to be very precise about our because my mother had this French woman who she was living with. And she just one day, she's just like, oh, let's see what is in the house. There's some pears here. There is some sugar. There is some butter.
Sugar.
And she just like whipped up this transcendent apple up. So it was a pear upside down cake.
A tarte tatin.
Yeah.
Of pears.
Mm-hmm. And she just like, oh, it's not very good. It's not very flavorful.
French people are different because they have such a deeper connection to food than most people.
It's part of their cultural inheritance.
It is part of their cultural inheritance. Yeah. And they truly believe that they know food better than anyone else. And I've had French people tell me that they know more about food than anyone else. And in a way, they are strange. Because if you've ever been to Paris, old ladies can eat and eat and eat and eat and drink. And then they're going to have a whole wheel of brie. And then they're going to have 3 scoops of ice cream. And then they're going to have champagne. And after, you know, Mignon days for dessert. And they can eat you under the table. And we get fat. French people, they don't get fat because they walk.
Well, that's true. And what about Thai people? Because this is a very interesting thing. And I learned this after the fact of the dish Pad Thai, that it was kind of developed as a way to impose cultural imperialism over the Thai people, because before the current regime, there was a lot of variety on how food and language was done. And so they wanted sort of like the way Europeans did, a thousand
you mean like
years
beer?
Ago. What?
With beer, you mean where it's a standard recipe?
There's a standard recipe. And so Thai people are very precise and they don't like to deviate from the ingredients and the amounts in their food.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, also too, the Vietnamese are like that in that way. But then the Vietnamese, you know, they were colonized by France. So there is this weird fusion that is an old fusion of Vietnamese, Franco-Vietnamese things. So you'll have that sandwich that is made on French bread, but it's got Vietnamese spices and lemongrass. Mm-hmm. But there's also like a pâté inside of this sandwich. And then Vietnamese people are crazy about French pastries because that is a very big thing in Vietnam and also in Korea right now. French things are very big in K-towns all over the United States. French bakeries are popping up all over K-town.
Well, I'm trying to rein in this conversation here, but it's like you actually work with a lot of Korean students as an instructor of fashion and design at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Shout out to my alma mater. And so much that, like, if 50% of your students come from that specific
From Asia,
country.
I have Japanese, Taiwanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, Korean, a lot. I have some sort of special rapport with that part of the world.
So being a contestant on MasterChef, and you're bringing all this culture, all this inheritance, all this experience, and then they stick you with some other guys who are like fry cooks from a diner. What was there? I mean, you like could have been, you know, I mean, you beat them up and, you know, fed them their lunch back, stole their lunch money for them.
There's some people that, you know, growing up in the South Side of Chicago, you have to be tough, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wasn't, you know, alarmed by any of those people. Not at all. Some of them were alarmed with me. And that's where some of the conflict comes in there. Because there's a couple of people on that show, you know, I eat girls like that for breakfast. So
you're like, I'm from Chicago. You told one of them, what was the story to freak them out? He wanted to, you told them you were a vampire?
Yeah, I told them I was vampiric, and it worked.
He was a superstitious contestant. What was his name? Are you not supposed to tell?
No, I can say his name.
Because this didn't make it onto the show.
Yeah, his name was Steven. But Steven and I are good friends now.
Okay.
That was just when we were battling it out. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to use some sort of a weapon, and my age is my secret weapon.
Do you mind me asking you how old you are?
I am
human years?
I am the magical age of 53.
And you look good, girl. Black don't crack.
Thank you, baby. I only have one wrinkle, and I'm sitting on it.
So this contestant is a little bit superstitious, and he was kind of like going, are you Wiccan? Are you into voodoo? Because you have a Cajun past.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people thought that I could.
Yeah.
I think that they, you know, a lot of people thought about that and that I was, you know, hoodoo queen and that I could, you know, throw a hex on them. But, you know, basically
the hallelujah,
you know, what voodoo is it's not black art and it's not wishing bad on someone, because if you do that, it's going to come back on you three times. So I don't ever do anything bad to anybody, but I do have a certain amount of energy that is positive energy that can be utilized when I need it. And that is what I did with Steven.
And behind the scenes, he, I guess, was kept asking you about your age and he was obsessed about it. And instead of being butthurt about it, sort of like Tempest du Jour was in the last season of RuPaul's Drag Race, you just were like, yes, darling, I'm a vampire.
Yes, it's quite easy for me to stay outside in the daytime. It makes me stronger.
And then he cut himself and he started bleeding.
Then he started to bleed.
And you got thirsty.
And so what was your reaction? You kind of like turned over and you started like...
Yeah, I kind of gave drooling. Him some nice, you know...
And you threw him off his game.
Yeah, I really did throw him off his game, I think. But I don't think Steven would ever admit that.
Mm.
Why would now the experience of how many contestants were there? I think it was like 12.
Well, when total? We first started out, it was I think it was 40.
Yeah,
and then they whittled that down to 20. Then it's in the top 16. Then you're top 12, and then top 10. And
do you feel like in other reality TV shows, they usually get asked that are competitive? That it's not just about how well you perform with the food or the challenges they gave you, but it's also like what kind of narrative and information you present. And you're obviously like a very colorful, fascinating person.
Well,
so.
You know, I think that people have to, you know, TV is a show. So that's just, to me, just like a fashion show. You just don't wear your, you know, simple, easy things in a fashion show. That's why they call it a show. So I wanted to make sure that I brought it hard, flaming, piping hot on a silver platter. And food just happens to be one of the things that I also do very well.
And I think it's interesting the relationship that you had with Gordon Ramsay, who's the host of the show. He really seemed like you bewitched him a little bit. He was like, he was into you.
Some people actually said that I did work my voodoo on Gordon. And I was wearing voodoo necklaces and things like that. And people believe what they want to believe, but I know what I can do with just my eyeballs. So Gordon responded to what I gave him.
Oh, so he was kind of like a feeding off you via improv.
Yeah, Gordon is just great, and Gordon's got a great energy. So just like you two guys, when I, you know, if you give me something, I'll bite it.
Well, every time you had like
too hard.
Every time you had like a banana, he would make some sort of like phallic joke.
A banana, a sausage, a meatball, anything that was could be made into double entendre. He's very quick.
Did you purposefully choose any kind of ingredients to try to?
No, I didn't. I didn't. And he would. He could find anything. He's very quick. He's very smart. He's very. Now, you know, on his toes.
Before you got on the show, you obviously, like most people on the internet, seen or heard of Gordon Ramsay from his very notorious episode of Kitchen Nightmares.
Oh, yeah. We watch all of the Gordon shows.
Amy's Baking Company, who, by the way, and I don't know if people know this, they closed their doors for officially this summer in July.
Oh, I wanted to go.
But, you know, behind every crazy woman is somebody to fight with her. And certainly Chef Gordon Ramsay gave her a run for her money. Were you worried that he was going to sort of turn on you or?
Oh, you know, well, you always have to worry about what Gordon is going to be. It's like, it's you know, Gordon is like, you know, it's like meeting Jesus or
an angry Jesus,
Godzilla. It's like, you know, Gordon is not an easy person, and neither is a good chef. You know, a quiet chef is an out of business chef, and a quiet army sergeant is a dead sergeant. So Gordon is like a sergeant in a way. He wants the very best. He demands the very best. He's going to get the very best. Otherwise, you're out of there.
Do you feel like your art school training prepared you to do well in MasterChef? Because I always feel like in art school, it is kind of like being on a reality TV show. Because the teachers always come up with, you know, some crazy assignments. And you're just like, okay, let's do it. You know.
Yeah, it was kind of the other side of the coin. Because
you were the student.
I was the student in this situation on MasterChef. So I wanted to be a good student and show them that I could be, you know, a hard body. And fit right into their ideal of what they wanted MasterChef to be. So whatever advice Gordon gave me or Graham gave me or Christina gave me,
There were the judges on the show.
Yep, the three judges. I would take any of their advice without attitude and implement it and put it into action so that they could see that I was a survivor and that I could make a bounce back. And I did that a couple of different times on the show. Which Gordon really liked that.
Now, some of the fans of the show have been creating, what is that called?
Slash fiction.
Slash fiction.
Slash art.
Slash art of images of you and Chef Gordon Ramsay as lovers.
Oh, yes. All kinds of stuff.
What does Gordon think about it?
I don't know. I'm afraid to ask. I'm totally afraid to ask. You know, Gordon with his wife and four kids, they're such a great family. I don't even know if Gordon's looking at this, and I kind of hope he's not.
You should get it and print it on a t-shirt and send it to
him. Oh, God. Somebody's already made a t-shirt that says, "Release your inner Tommy."
Honey, we should all strive to be like you. In these kind of like experiences, you're sort of emotionally isolated and you're certainly very close to your husband, Roger.
Yeah.
And, you're a teacher. You're a very nurturing person. Uh-huh. And they're putting you in a situation where you're not be able to nurture other people. You're not able to have somebody to, at the end of the day, reflect upon the experience.
So in that situation where I'm not able to, nurture someone, I turn to the other side of the coin and I attack.
What was your most effective attack besides the vampire?
Oh, my most effective attack, I believe, was probably when I was a team captain and nobody was listening to me and they were kind of throwing me under the bus and they were complaining about my leadership skills, which they've never seen me in my classroom with 16 international students. And they think I have no leadership skills whatsoever. So they were kind of using me as a scratching post, but I regained control by using my two magic words. Shut up. And they did. Yeah. And we won that challenge. But it's funny how people portray you when they meet you. They want to, put a certain trait on you that is not really your trait. Mm-hmm. Because this thing of me being unorganized is not me. The thing of them accusing me of being slow, I'm not really slow. I'm kind of like a hyper chihuahua, right? And how could I be slow if someone else is 250 pounds more than me? So you judge who's now, really slow.
Did you ever feel like you were given a challenge that stumped you the most?
A challenge that stumped me the most. All of the challenges were tricky.
But what was like the low point or the one that you were just like, I don't know if I'm going to make this?
A tag team challenge is really terrible because you have to depend on another person to do half of your work. And what if they don't want to do it?
Because Mark and I kind of sometimes when we're cooking together, and you can see that on Cooking with Drag Queens, we start fighting.
Well, and things that start to burn sometimes. Well, we usually edit most of the fights out.
Yeah.
So luckily that's not there.
The poor drag queen's like doing this with us, and she's kind of left going, Oh, God. Well, you've been in that situation where you're cooking in a restaurant or in a work environment, and the person who's running the restaurant may be really insane. Like, one common mistake that restaurants make is that for some weird reason, they want to have everything they've ever eaten in their life that they liked on that menu. Uh-huh. And so you don't get just like, sandwiches, salads, and you're done. You get Thai food and Indian food and French food and South American
around the world in 80 ways.
Girl, and I'm like, and the kitchen's about the size of your dinner table.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I don't know if I really want to have a traditional restaurant. Because in Chicago, this is right now is the epicenter of the restaurant world. And the James Beard Awards has moved here from New York City. So we have such an incredible atmosphere and a landscape of restaurants that is happening. And there's a renaissance that's happening. So I think I have to do something different. I can't just do another steakhouse. I can't just do another Italian place. Can't do another thing. 'Cause I'm kind of sick of this trendiness and hipsterism, this pork belly sous vide cupcake moment that we're living in is so tiresome, and I want to do something.
I want that on a t-shirt.
New.
Pork belly cupcake sous vide.
Sous vide pork belly cupcake. This is real.
Is that
sickness.
Actually a food item?
No, but I'm sure that somebody's done a bacon cupcake.
Macaroons.
And pork. This pork belly, and at one point, every restaurant that you go to would have pork belly on it. And pork belly is something that you can go to Chinatown and get it for $3. Mm-hmm. And 5 years ago, no white woman in her right mind would have ever been seen ordering pork belly off of a menu. And now everybody's ordering pork belly and they get these tiny little morsels and they're, you know, sauced.
But they do taste very good.
Of course, pork belly's bacon. Bacon never hurts. Porky goodness like that, you gotta have some bacon.
To paraphrase Paula Deen, bacon is everything, you ignorant bitch.
That is the truth.
Wait, let me pull out the fan here. Punctuate that.
Really?
Well, tell us about your Caviar Supper Club.
The Caviar Club. I've wanted to do something different that's not a restaurant. And because I'm so connected with the fashion world and art and travel, I'd like to combine all of those different genres of art because I am an interdisciplinary artist, first and foremost. I'm a fashion designer. I'm an artist. I'm an avid traveler.
What is it that you were like when you were young or in your relationship with Roger, you turned to him one time and said, you need to take me to Paris or we're now. Through.
Yes. I remember telling him, we've been together for 30 years, but I remember telling Roger once, I want to go to Paris and I want to go now. And I'm not going to wait until I'm an old hunchback. I need to go now while I'm still cute. I need to go now while I can get into the clubs without having to wait in a line. I need to go now while I can still wear all of the Junior Watanabe. I've got to go now. If you wait until I'm 35, I never want to go.
And so you guys went that summer.
So we went. Yeah. Roger took me on my first plane trip to Paris, and then we got on the train and went to Amsterdam. And
so the future of the Supper Club, the Caviar Club.
Mm-hmm. I think that the Caviar Club has to be a performative space. It's got to be a high-concept cabaret or some sort of a futuristic bistro. And I want it to be the kind of a thing where it's going to be fashion, it's going to be food, it's going to be workshops, it's going to be pop-up ideas, things that can totally stimulate you. Say, for instance, like no menu. You come in and all the hors d'oeuvres are served hanging from the ceiling on strings.
I love that shit.
Or you come in and there's no food. It's all fashion. Or you come in and there's a beautiful lunch and then there's a beautiful dinner. And afterwards, my nephew, who's one of the hottest DJs in Chicago, will throw down a volcanic beat. So I'd like to do something that is, you know, a cool space, a happening space. And quite possibly, I will have guest chefs like Graham Elliott, ooh, Gordon Ramsay, ooh, Christina Tosi, Chef Samuel from MasterChef Junior, Little Joshua, Little Levi, who's the cutest little chef in the whole world, and things like that. Something different. And plus, I've got my students at the Art Institute. So I have non-stop, deep well to draw on.
So do you view this as something that's going to be constantly open, or is this like an event?
I think that it might be a monthly event. Mm-hmm. I don't want something that people can actually get used to. Mm. I don't want people to be able to put their thumb on what's going to happen next. And I want people to constantly have, you know, nameless apprehension about what's going to happen next. Almost, I want something that's borderline frightening. You know how Studio 54 scare you to death? And so you've got to come up with, or the Limelight, or the, you know, the Palladium. You've got to come up with the monstrous outfit because you've got to get past the doorman. And I don't want anybody to be able to come. I don't want it to be accessible.
Mm. You want basically the Grace Jones of the world.
Yeah. That's right. I want the beautiful people. But you know what? I want fat people. I want gay people. I want the new, young, hip skinheads. I want everybody. But I want it to be a perfect cocktail of people.
You want people to dress to impress.
Of course.
Be the most they are capable of.
Of course,
being.
I want everybody to be themselves times 10.
Now, in your early days, and we know about this because we were talking to you at an event, a birthday party for a friend of ours. You used to cook for the comedian Richard Pryor.
Yes, yes. I cooked for a film caterer, and I used to travel around in a food truck. This is 25 years ago before people were doing food trucks. So I met these people, and they had a catering business. And the caterer got very successful, and we started doing all the gallery openings downtown in the Suhu Building and Museum of Contemporary Art. And I got to go into the most fabulous situations, most unbelievable homes with the most fabulous people, the A-list of Chicago. And this is when I was very young. So I was getting to see the elite of Chicago from a really young age and the super, super hyper-sophisticated, fashionable people, right? So one day, the caterer that I was working for fell ill and died.
From what? Food poisoning?
No, it wasn't food poisoning. And she was sick for a while, and she passed away. But she had parties planned.
Yeah.
So we had to take all the parties, and we had to finish all of her clients, right? So a lot of those people continued to ask me to continue to do things. And I didn't even have a license. So I started doing things right out of my house, and it got bigger and bigger. And finally, one day, I got a call, and I did some commercial catering for a commercial and food styling for a commercial. And then I got a Richard Pryor. And then from Richard Pryor, I got when Brooke Shields came to Chicago to do Endless Love and was directed by Robert Redford. We did macrobiotic food for them.
Mm. Would you cook for Richard Pryor cocaine sandwiches?
This is so funny because Richard Pryor had converted to Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so enamored of the famous Richard Pryor, right? But I had a special job, and my special job was every morning, and I could get in trouble for this, but every morning I had to sneak past the Nation of Islam bodyguards with a pork sausage sandwich for Richard Pryor.
Well, shout out to Richard Pryor Jr.
Hey, bye.
Oh, honey, I know. And he's been having back problems, but I think he's doing better now. So,
gotta eat.
I know, honey. It's like, listen, your health is so important. You only have one body. Treat it well.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So there, from there, you sort of like, you've always had these really interesting jobs, and it's like now you're a full-time, you're tenured faculty at the Art Institute, School of the SAIC. Honey.
Yeah, I've been there for over 20 years now.
You will never lose your job.
No, they won't fire me. I've even, you know, I was kind of...
I tried it.
They reprimanded me for talking about business and art and that the students needed to make money from their art. And because this is an art school, they don't have a commercial focus of business, right? I always talk about that because that's how I've survived. And
see,
you have to do
something. I got into trouble for doing that, too, when I was teaching there as well as a grad student.
Yeah, they reprimanded me and told me I'm not supposed to talk about business so much, but I bring in my professional experience to my students, and that's what they want to hear. So
well,
you've got to pay the bills. There's no such thing as a starving artist in my book. It's a stupid artist. If you're not selling your things, who wants it? You're making the wrong thing. If nobody wants to eat, same with cooking. If nobody wants to eat a buffalo-flavored popsicle, don't make that.
Ooh, I saw the black girl just came out and the head went.
Yeah, don't make that.
Pop your tongue, huh?
You know, really.
And so, yeah, I mean, and one way that I look at it is like, listen, art isn't about an idea and you want to develop those ideas. But in order to bring those ideas to life, you need materials.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we live in a society where money is exchanged for goods and services.
Yes, it is a service. Fashion is a service, and food is a service. And I think of fashion and food as surrealism. It's the same thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Fashion is the type of a thing that if you make something good, your client is going to like it. They're going to appreciate it. They're going to want it again. And they're going to come back the next season, and they're going to get a new jacket or a new dress or a new corset or a new pair of gloves or a new hat. They're going to know that you do this certain thing, and they're going to come back every time. Food is the same way. If they like the food, they're going to come back to your restaurant. They may not want the same thing every time. So you're going to have to continue to evolve and continue to invent and continue to entertain that particular person. Mm. So fashion and food, to me, is the same thing. And I make my fashion just as attractive as the food. My food is beautiful. My fashion is beautiful. It's consumable. And you want more.
And it's unfortunate today, I think, that we live in a times where so much of our fashion, so much of the clothing that we wear is kind of like junk food.
Yeah.
You know, where it's not fashion. Just like, it's not just unappealing, but it's also like hurting the environment. It's oppressive to other people, and it's economically unsustainable.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of going back with my students. I try to get them off the computer. And I show them some very old school techniques. Technique is the thing that will sustain you. The computer is always going to continue to change rapidly. And you may not be able to get a grip on your art form if you are focusing only on the technological aspect of it. So I show them things that are from the 1800s, things that are from the 1900s. And I consider myself a futurist. But I am also very old school. So in fashion, I do things the old, old haute couture way.
For but example, I can also,
I do everything is, I cut all of my fabrics out in the bias. I do my own embroidery. I make my own embroidery materials. I make my own handmade silk flowers. I do my own ruching. I do my own fitting. I do a 26-boned corset. I do French evening gloves from a 1800s pattern. So I have, but at the same time, I will go back so that I can go forward. Mm-hmm. So I get all of the newest, most interesting cyber fabrics from Holland, from Belgium, and rubbers and plastics and neoprenes and latexes are coming from all over the world. But I sew them together using old-fashioned technique. Say, for instance, like I do latex, but with French seams.
You sew latex? I thought that had to be glued together.
You can glue it. You can sew it. There's lots of ways to get things together. Mm. So I do lots of things.
Does the latex have to be treated or it has to be a certain thickness in order to be sewed?
Oh, there's so many new latexes and so many new cyber fabrics out there. And that's one of the things that I introduce my students to, the newest of the new stuff. And new moldable thermoplastics like Fuss Shape and Wonderflex and all of these things that you can use with acrylic. And I've got everything at my fingertips at the Art Institute. Laser cutters, vacuform plastic machines, 3D digital printers, robotic fingers.
You're like a Batman villain, but with food and fashion.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have to do something to keep people edutained.
What do robot fingers do?
They extrude materials. So you can put plastic cartridges into the machine, and the needle is the finger. And it puts out layers of plastic, then a layer of glue, than a layer of plastic, and it can do something up into it like 1,000 layers.
It's like a 3D pen.
Yeah, it's like a 3D pen.
Yeah, those are really fun to play with.
So there's also, you know, food grade 3D printers.
I've seen those. They look kind of unsettling. It's basically squirting like pate into a shape of a doll or something.
Well, there's something that I'm working on right now that is in development. We are actually growing sugar crystals with the computer.
Ooh.
And that is going to become a line of jewelry.
Edible jewelry, obviously.
No, it's not going to be edible.
Well,
it's just made out of sugar. No, we're going to probably coat it. But so far, we took it and showed it in Istanbul at the Biennale last year.
What does that even look like?
They look like oversized jewels. And we are letting the computer and the organic shape of the natural crystal, we program it into a program in the computer, and the computer actually grows it. So the sugar crystal is microscopic, and now we have kind of like an inch-long baguette jewel on a ring.
You're a mad genius.
Yeah.
Is it polished like a diamond, or is it like a quartz crystal growing like from a cave or something?
Yeah, it kind of looks like quartz like that. Kind of looks like that. And you can also formulate them to go in different directions. So if I wanted a hoop, like to become a handle of a purse.
Yeah.
One of the designs is a circular hoop where the sugar crystals are actually rotating.
Is it hard or would it break?
It's very hard.
Because like they have those bottles that they use in Hollywood, like the Coke bottles that they hit over people's head. Yeah, they're made out of sugar.
Yeah, no, this is really hard. And it's unbreakable.
How hard? Oh, unbreakable.
Yeah, it's unbreakable.
From sugar?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yep. And some of the paper things we're doing out of paper, you can't tell if it's paper or ceramic.
Now, where you teach, they actually filmed one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah.
Mahogany.
Mahogany. Emphasis on the hog.
In your actual classroom?
Yes. In room 1003 was the opening scene of Mahogany. Mm. And you know, in the beginning of the movie, she's riding the Wabash L train.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And her job was in Marshall Fields. Marshall Fields was where I had my first job.
Oh, wow.
So you feel like your life and that character that Diana Ross played in the movie have a lot of parallels.
Yeah, there's some funny, crazy things. I saw the movie Mahogany 14 times when I was 14.
Wow. You know, that's one of RuPaul's favorite films of all time.
Yeah, it's everybody's favorite film. And that's the movie that actually led me into fashion illustration and to become a fashion designer.
So when you're teaching in that classroom, do you ever reflect upon your serendipity of your
life? It is a very weird thing, and the word serendipitous is correct, because when I was little, I used to take piano lessons down the street from where I teach school right now. And when I would ride the train, which was the same train that Diana Ross used to ride, I used to look in the windows along Wabash and think, when I grow up, I'm going to live inside of one of those windows in one of those stores. And where Carson Perry Scott was, a department store, there were department stores there, and I could look in the windows of the department stores there. And this was before the word loft.
Mm-hmm.
So I fantasized about living in a store. And strangely enough, now I do live in one of those windows on Wabash, and I teach in one of those. I live down the street on Wabash, and my classroom is in one of those windows looking out at the L tracks. So I kind of had this, and I'm clairvoyant, so I kind of, you know, foresaw that I could feel it, and my students, I'm teaching them how to be clairvoyant.
What did you think of Diana's designs for the movie Mahogany?
Oh, it was fantastic. That Kabuki collection.
Now, to clarify, the character in the movie is a fashion designer who's sort of like, you know,
becomes a model and then goes back to fashion design.
But in real life, the actress, Diana Ross, actually designed a lot of the clothes for the film that she eventually wore.
Yes, she did a lot of those clothes, and they were fantastic clothes. Those are iconic outfits. That purple dress where she fell into the fountain in Rome.
Yeah.
That big fox muff.
Mm.
Or that rainbow shawl,
the pleated rainbow.
Imitated.
Peacock rainbow.
I tried to do that, but I used the wrong fabric.
Yeah. Because
that fabric, I don't know what that fabric
was. Yeah, that was a silk organza or silk chiffon.
Yeah.
And it was sunburst pleated.
Do you have a sunburst pleater? Because I need to borrow one.
No, you have to send things out to be pleated from a sunburst pleater, because the machine is a giant machine. So if you need something sunburst pleated, I can tell you where to send it.
Oh, really? So, so you basically construct it and you ship it to them and they
You have to send them the fabric and they'll pleat it and then they send it back to you and you put it together.
So if I ask you, know where you're going to?
Do you know where you're going to?
Do you know what life is?
Tell the story about the coat. You told us a story about her fancy coat.
Oh, yeah. When Diana Ross came to the school to teach, to do Mahogany, the first day that she arrived, you know, this is Diana Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And Diana Ross is a fashion plate. And there's an older teacher at the school now who teaches corsetry.
Mm-hmm.
And she was there when Diana walked in. And they needed somebody to watch Diana's coat. This coat was a purple, floor-length, black gamma sable with a train.
Oh, my God.
This coat must have cost $75,000 to $1,000. And so she had to stand there and hold that coat all day.
Because she couldn't put it down?
You couldn't put it on a hanger.
She couldn't lay it on a desk?
Oh, I don't think she laid it on a desk. If you got to hold Diana Ross's coat, Baby, I'd be wearing that coat.
She tried it on, I'm sure.
I would have had to try it on. I would have sniffed it and everything.
Now, on MasterChef, you were told that you had the best dessert in the entire history of the show.
Yeah, there was something that Gordon really liked.
What was it?
It was a sweet corn panna cotta. It was a corn challenge where it was a mystery box and they picked corn. Up the box and it was corn on the cob. And we had approximately, 30 minutes to an hour to come up with something made out of corn. And I decided to do a corn panna cotta, and I used the corn cobs, boiled them in milk. I took the corn off and pureed it and strained it and put it through a chinoise so that there was no particles of corn. And then I used a French feuilletine gelatin, which nobody else knew how to use. So I used that to make my panna cotta firm up and gel, but it was light and airy as a cloud, not hard like Jell-O. Melt in your mouth, and it's a traditional Italian dessert, but I put my twist on it by using corn, and I did, I took popcorn and made like caramel corn.
Yeah.
That was another little garnish on the plate. And then I used candy corn, like Halloween corn, mm-hmm. and I melted it down and mixed it with white chocolate, and I made little round coins. And then I took fresh corn shoots, like the before it turns into a tiny baby corn in the cob,
mm-hmm. yeah.
the little shoot, and I used that as my garnish. So it was actually corn five ways.
Mm, that's a lot of corn.
Yeah, and it was very, very, you know, corn has a very fragrant, mm-hmm. And I used a Tahitian vanilla bean because this was all about the perfume of the corn.
Did the corn really come through in the custard, or was it?
Christina said she would have liked to see a little bit more corn flavor in mm-hmm. that, and I understand. But Gordon said it was magical.
Mm.
He loved it.
Tommy Walton, you are magical. We absolutely love you.
I love you too.
I mean, we've spent lots of time talking. You're this person that's always been in the background of my life. Ever since I've been to Chicago,
I've been watching you for a long time.
Like, well, because you're a vampire, so you're stalking people.
Because you used to be, I guess, would you call yourself a club kid back in the day?
Yeah, I guess you could say I was a club kid.
You and your partner,
me
Roger.
Me and my husband, Roger, we always went out. We went out like every night, and we were always in some sort of outrageous getup or some frightening outfit or, you know, with costuming on and everything. So it was during that club kit time, and that's how we morphed. And we used that as our fashion stage, too. You know, in the early days. So I was able to go out wearing, you know, styrofoam outfits and, you know, Lady Gaga and her meat dress, that old thing. I did that 20 years before Lady Gaga was even a thought in her mother's belly.
What kind of meat did you wear?
I wore a T-bone steak as a bra. I made a T-bone steak into a thong, and I had several meat outfits. Mm. I did, of course, I was always fascinated by Josephine Baker, and I still am, the French showgirl from St. Louis, who was the toast of Paris.
And her banana dance.
The banana dance? Well, I did a kielbasa sausage dance. So I made myself a skirt out of kielbasa sausages, and then I also made myself a beautiful bra out of salami and Oscar Mayer olive loaf. And I went to a party that was for the executives Oscar Mayer and post Armor Meats, wearing my meat outfit. And I can tell you,
smelled the entire room.
You know, it didn't really smell, but what I remember distinctly about the meat dress is how sticky it was and how everything started to stick to me and how cold it was.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
So
I like
that is what, yep, me too.
What was the reception like?
I don't remember anybody coming up to me saying a word. Because in those days, I would make myself so alarming, people would not approach me. Mm. It's a little bit different now. I think I've opened myself up to the world. So I'm accessible now to people, and everybody wants to come up and kiss
you. Kind of confuse though people sometimes. They always like, they want to put some kind of ethnicity on you. Filipino people think you're Filipino. Vietnamese people think you're Vietnamese. Are you, Tommy?
I'm every woman. Everybody sees themselves in me, and I think this is a good thing on television, because old people think that I'm like them. Young people think that I'm young. People don't know what my age is. People don't know what my race is. Vietnamese people think I'm Vietnamese. Black people think I'm black. Puerto Rican people think I'm Puerto Rican. Lesbians think I'm a lesbian. Everything is great. I just embrace everybody. And
tell the listeners what's on your birth certificate, because I think it's so interesting.
My birth certificate. I was born in 1962, when sex was still dirty and the air was clean. My birth certificate says colored, spelled in the French way, C-O-L-O-U-R-E-D, colored.
Because your family was Creole. And
yeah,
so
my family's Creole, and that's not, you don't put Creole on the birth certificate. Mm. You know, that's not a race.
And they would have, back then, they would have put Negro if you were darker.
They would have put Negro back in those days, yep.
And so it's so interesting.
Mine doesn't say Negro.
Well, I don't want to be like a birther.
Right. Yeah.
But do you have a copy of it?
I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you.
Yeah.
And my birth certificate. Oh, my picture that I sent to MasterChef is actually really funny, because they kept asking me, what are you? What are you? How old are you? What's your age? Could we see a copy of your birth certificate? Could we see a copy of your driver's license? Can we see a copy of your passport? So I sent them my current passport. And I also sent them my first passport from when I was 11 years old with my Michael Jackson afro.
Tommy, if people want to follow you on social media, what's the best place to do that?
You can go to my Facebook page. I have a fan page that is called the Tommy Walton Caviar Club. And you can also look for me on Twitter and on Instagram under Tommy Walton and Caviar Club.
Girl, put me on the list.
Certainly, I certainly shall.
I will dress to impress.
Oh, you don't have to wear any clothes, Fausto.
No.
You can come as you are.
You. Remember, folks, Feast of Fun is made possible because of financial support of fabulous, fierce people like you. Go to feastoffun.com/donate and make a contribution. Or even better yet, help support Season 2 of Cooking with Drag Queens. Right now, we're trying to raise $25,000 by November 12th.
Get that money.
Get the money, hunties, for Season 2. And if we don't reach our goal, that'll be the end of Cooking with Drag Queens.
No,
but it ain't gonna happen, honey.
Ain't gonna.
Because the children are out there ready to pop the corn and feed themselves.
They're hungry for seconds. And so we'll give them seconds, but we have to raise that money. And so just follow us on Kickstarter. Just search Feast of Fun or Cooking with Drag Queens and we'll pop right up.
You think you know everything about cooking and drag queens? You haven't seen nothing yet, honey. Wait till we start cooking and delivering Season 2, hunty.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to get involved in this crazy
shit? I sure do. You know, I can snatch it up in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah, honey. I absolutely adore you, and it's like, you are so much fun, and so visually. I know this is it's a crime that we're doing a podcast here.
It should have been video.
Everybody, put your nose to the screen and smell my aroma and my fragrant personality.
It smells like tangerines. And blood. Now, before we leave.
Yeah.
So, guys, go check that out. And if even if it's like $5, what you need to do, because it may not get funded, put in $1,000. And if it doesn't get funded, hey, you'd be like, look, Fausto, I tried.
And you can do that again.
Because what?
I was just going to give the exact URL.
Oh, go for it.
Kickstarter.com/profile/feastoffun.
That's right.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of things, but it's Season 2, the Cooking with Drag Queens there. And we have a little video that shows you some cool behind the scene moments that didn't make it onto the series. And there's two more episodes, one with Lady Bunny and one with Katya Zamolochikova.
Coming out
soon. The Russian mail order bride everyone ordered but never got. Well, she's the real deal, honey.
Ooh.
She is fun. And she's really, in many ways, the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race Season 7. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Even though she wasn't the formal one. In the hearts and minds of the fans, I believe that she really is.
Everybody loved her.
She's stunning, you know. No shade to Violet Chachki, who is an incredible snatchy queen and a flying through the air aerialist. But there's something really warm and beautiful and hilarious and transcendent about Katya Zamolochikova, and we're actually going into her hotel room as she's getting ready for a gig and showing her in her underwear in the bathroom.
Ooh, I cannot wait.
Getting all pretty, honey. Really? Going from, you know, a good-looking man to this extraordinary vision of motherly beauty.
Beyondness.
Oh, yeah. And then guess what we cooked with her?
What?
Is a Bush Noel.
Oh my gosh, that's not easy.
It was you know, the hardest part of it is that we tried to make caramel moss.
Oh.
And we couldn't. Mark and I have a hard time with.
We didn't cook the caramel long enough as well.
Yeah. It's just when we made taffy too, we made taffy for the Kickstarter video and it totally was a disaster.
Oh,
well,
no.
Well, the first time we made it was fine, but then we doubled the recipe and that's when you double the recipe.
You have to do it in smaller quantities.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Well, and that's not an easy thing to do, you guys. You tried to do that? That's not easy.
It was a hot mess.
That's the taffy sitting right there in that bowl.
But it's
really?
Yeah. Yeah, but the taffy's been there for like a couple of weeks and now, so the thing about sugar, it kind of like absorbs
the moisture in the
air.
Moisture, so whatever cornstarch is in there, I feel is like moving to the outside of it and the sugar's drawing in on itself.
Oh, it could change
something.
If you don't have the correct.
Yeah, because they put all sorts of chemicals in those, like Skittles and Starburst to emulsify it. Yeah.
Keep it. But fresh taffy is fantastic.
And it could be dangerous, too, you know.
It is?
It's hot, with the sugar, when you're melting, it's dangerously hot.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, honey,
And this it sticks.
Like, I can burn in the kitchen.
Me, too. I can cook in that kitchen. As long as that stove is red hot to the touch, my man's happy.
What's your favorite thing to cook, Tommy?
I'm not going to go there. What's my favorite thing to cook? I really like Exotica, right? But I'd like Magret de Canard, which is a French duck breast. And I like to grill it. And then I like to smoke it with applewood smoke. Mm. And then I will do something with that is a classical French thing to cut the fattiness and the richness of the duck. So I want to put some sort of a fruit like figs and grapes and blackberry compote. Mm. And then I need to have something crunchy with that. So I'm going to use the duck skin and crisp that up and make that into like a duck chicharrón. And then I need to have some cracklings like that. And then we need some other texture on the plate. So I would do some sort of a walnut sand or a pistachio dust.
That sounds perfect wonderful. For the autumn, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Feeling it.
I'm feeling it right now.
Okay.
Get cooking.
Thank you so much, Tommy.
Oh, it's Thanks, my Tom. Pleasure.
Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.